Can anybody know? Can people hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, thanks so much. I have a tendency to speak fast, so if anyone, so I'm going to try to speak slowly, but if it starts happening naturally, you can always do the like this, which will slow me down. It's just growing up in New York City, it's just something I can't shake. So I want to just thank everyone, especially Todd, who I see here, for making this event possible, inviting me. It's the first time I've been to a socialism conference in my life, and so it's really wonderful to be in a room with all these comrades and see how everything came together in this incredibly historic period that we're in. I just wanted to make clear, though it's not going to change anything I really say, but I'm here on my own accord. I came paid my own way. So I will talk a lot about our revolution. I'm open to talking about that, but I will be a mixture of my remarks will be about that side of my life, but also my volunteer life, you know, in DSA. I've been a member for about 15 years, so I'll be reflecting on both. So if you're wondering why I'm talking about both kind of evenly, it's because I think that they're both relevant for this. So to kind of get into it, I'll talk a little bit about what I've seen change with Bernie Sanders in general, not the person, but things around him. Then what I will talk about a little bit is about how does our revolution and organizations like it fit broadly into this political context, especially if he becomes president, and then talk about things that I'm optimistic about, borrowing on history, both in and outside the United States, and things that I'd be worried about under Sanders' presidency as well. So then I'll hand it over to Mike. And we'll try to make sure we have sufficient time to hear from you guys, because it's important this is a dialogue, not just between he and I. So I took the time over the past 2 years to read kind of Sanders, has written several books, and most recently he wrote a book, not coincidentally, called Our Revolution, reflecting on his time running for president in 2016, and then most recently he wrote a book called Where Do We Go From Here? Which he published a few months ago, which is a collection of speeches and kind of almost a diary of like what his life has been like since the last presidential election. And so a couple of things stuck out to me in the differences between the books and politically. And so one was, I remember him in Our Revolution, the only group that he mentions is not Our Revolution, it's actually Progressive Democrats of America. And he says, like, I want to thank Progressive Democrats of America, or PDA, you know, for launching a petition to encourage me to run for president. And this was funny to me because DSA did the same thing. You know, we had a petition as well. I remember being on that committee with Boxcar and other folks, you know, just drafting up a petition encouraging our members to say, you know, Bernie should run for president. And then in this book, this newest book, he not only mentions PDA, but he does mention DSA, and he specifically talks about Ocasio-Cortez being a DSA member. And I thought that was very telling if I can only draw one specific thing, which shows that DSA is much more present around him, and that whether you think he did that because he wanted to appeal to DSA members or just because he noticed it, it was undeniable that, you know, as a movement, DSA, or as an organization, not as a movement, but as an organization, we are much more present in and around Bernie Sanders. And so you can see that somewhat with his staffing. I mean, lots of the presidential campaign are staffed by our comrades. You know, Our Revolution about a year ago was about, I'd say, about 50% DSA members. So it's very present to be around him. And so I think where that leads me to wonder is like, what would, in his first term, is like, what do these formations around him do, and how are they being influenced by democratic socialists? And I've reflected in other work I've done about, I don't have a term for them per se, but like, I guess you could call them like post-presidential organizations of individuals. And so what that, a lot of words I'm talking about specifically is that, like, except for Barack Obama, because he won, that's the only reason why, and he's still in this, like, lots of people who have very successful runs at the presidency in the Democratic Party since Jesse Jackson, what they do is they form organizations to continue their mission, you know, ostensibly, like, that's a nice way to say it, or just to kind of keep themselves politically relevant. So what are examples of this? Jesse Jackson had the Rainbow Coalition. Howard Dean had what's called Democracy for America, that is, he actually really is not involved with day-to-day anymore, but very much still exists. Kucinich, also not involved day-to-day, but to the Progressive Democrats of America came out of his campaign. And Bernie Sanders has our revolution. So those and Obama, which is relevant to what we're going to talk about, had what was called Obama for America. His campaign became Organizing for America. And so I think some key differences that I noticed between these men, they're all men, and their organizations is that it's a degree of autonomy in which they give them. And we're not here to discuss Jesse Jackson too much, but I think it's worth noting that, you know, people were also equally excited in certain ways about Jesse Jackson in the older DSA that people are about our revolution. And why was it? It was like the idea that, oh, there's going to be this larger formation, it's going to be, you know, not just socialist, it'll be something more multiracial, and we can come together and be and play a positive role in that. And I think Jesse Jackson, the difference between Bernie Sanders in this case, you know, Jesse, it was really his organization. You know, Jesse Jackson was not giving up control. Jesse Jackson did not encourage a democratically controlled organization. And the Rainbow Coalition, like, technically still exists, but went from having chapters and thousands of members to kind of being more, I don't think, more than a letterhead organization. I don't think anyone here has really seen a rainbow push sign around, you know, that I would have, that I vaguely remember seeing as a kid. You know, I do remember them being around my father's union. And whereas Bernie Sanders really did, and you know, give our revolution independence to do what it wants to do. And so it's still, so there's still a parameter. I mean, we exist both legally and in reality to support his mission, support his agenda. People, he's on our website, you know, the people who join are would probably most likely describe themselves as Bernie-crats over anything else. So it's not that he's not important, he's crucial, he's the essential, but he's not involved in the day-to-day. And that gives our revolution a lot of political freedom to do different things and experiment in ways that I think if we're looking at Organizing for America, as we came out of the Obama campaign, Obama, you know, mimicked a lot of what Jesse Jackson ended up doing, or did, or Howard Dean, you know, which is like, this is very much my organization, and it's going to do what I want it to do. So I think what's exciting about Bernie Sanders winning, if he wins, is the idea that we would have an opportunity not only to have formations like DSA and other socialist groups, and more importantly, you know, in terms of mass size of organized labor, you know, independent, but that Bernie Sanders' own organization would exist in a quasi-independent formation to hold him accountable, and that his bait, and that the board and itself could do work, though I assume it would be different how they relate to each other by the we, they as our revolution or a DSA to the Sanders presidency. There's some hope that there's going to be some at least independent, organic activism around that agenda. And so, and what I think is a good, and this is just my opinion, you know, some hope that I see is that, you know, I think Sanders does have a genuine commitment to a theory of change that involves, like, people in the streets, mass movements in action to enact an agenda. Whereas I think Barack Obama understood that theory of change, used it rhetorically, and then went out of his way through either Organizing for America to, you know, put in the DNC to, like, discourage, you know, people from ever going on strike, never walking on parents, like, never doing anything that was actually concrete to, you know, have a thing where people would actually be in action helping push his agenda. And I think had he been more open to that, you know, we might have had a public option now. You know, I mean, those are things that he wasn't willing to do, and we're not going to have to analyze him, but I mean, I think that's just an objective truth. So I really do think that that also presents a challenge for us in that what, you know, if we do have somebody who wants us to be in the streets, to be pushing them, how do you handle that? What do you do? Those aren't things I necessarily have an answer to. I think you know, we have to come to that collectively, but I'm just presenting that as like, you know, somebody gives, you know, someone gives you this opportunity, you have to take it, that you have to take advantage. It's not up for them to give you a pathway. And I think there's also differences that are both, you know, it's a double-edged sword because it creates people like Trump, but, you know, the ruling class is much more divided and incoherent you know, now than it was under Obama. Like, I think that there are serious divisions about where they want to go, how do they want to regain control. And I think, like, so for a concrete example I'll give is, I think, around the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was the failed trade agreement that Barack Obama tried to pass, that Hillary basically lied and said she was, like, against, even though she had negotiated it. And, you know, both in the ends up, it was, you had the three major candidates all said they were against TPP: Sanders, Clinton, and Trump. And I think the ruling class knew that only two of those people really were against TPP. It was Trump and Sanders. And that, and I'll never forget this anecdote, that when Trump became president, my friend said, "Oh my God, my roommate says all his company's sending all the people home." I was like, "What company?" He's like, "Oh, my roommate works for a consulting company on TPP and they're sending all the lobbyists back." Because they knew that, like, Trump was actually going to, like, hold to his word for TPP. So they clearly had been waiting to see who would win the presidency. I mean, if they had really believed that, like, everyone was against TPP, those people would have been sent home a lot earlier. So I think there's a real concern and divide there. And I think what I'm also hopeful about is that, and I think this conference shows, is that, you know, there's 1,200 people here. It's going to be probably about the same, more or less, at the DSA convention in about a month. You know, and these are coming from, I'm still remembering, you know, conferences where I was speaking to three or four people, not like 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, there is really a mass of people who are excited, have pent up optimism, and are ready to unleash it. And I think so, and it reminds me of, like, you know, there's always, like, the question, like, do we do better under Democrats and Republicans? And I think that's kind of a false dichotomy. And the reason I've changed on this, because I used to say, oh, we do better under Democrats. But I've seen, like, I mean, but none of this would probably have been possible, this growth, absent both a Sanders campaign and a Trump presidency. But I think where we don't want to be in is, we don't want to keep being in this, it's wonderful to have 1,200 people here, but if it's constantly reactive, that's what grinds a soul down. Like, you need to have something positive to work for. And I was just reflecting on, and Mike will go more into the details, like, my father was a student activist under Allende in Chile, and, like, in the stories he tells you, I mean, until it gets overthrown, you know, are relatively, like, positive stories of, like, you know, people taking power, people feeling, like, incredibly, like, liberated and ready to take on, to really build a new society. And my father, like, had come from a family that had land, though he had lost, his father, my grandfather had lost the land, and so his family, like, hated Allende and was very clear, like, they were, like, pissed at him when he would come back home from school and would, like, confront him about it. But what he would say is, like, you know, you would see these workers coming, like, when there was a crisis, students would come together, they would help rebuild houses after earthquakes. You know, it was just a different time of energy, and that's kind of what we would need to see and challenge. And so kind of where I have some concerns, and I think it's, like, less, and once again, it's less about Sanders himself and more as a challenge to us, because I think it's important for us to not get sucked into the American analysis of, like, let's individualize and psychoanalyze all these human beings. It's like, let's say we have Sanders and Sanders wants us to do well. What's going under that assumption? Like, do we have an organized labor that is ready to really push him? Because I think, as someone who lived in D.C. for 5 years, organized labor is used to do, the ones in D.C., I'm not talking about, like, Chicago teachers, I'm just talking specifically about people who operate in that bubble, are used to lobbying, used to, like, doing transactional politics. There's not, like, this sense of, like, wow, somebody says go be a social movement, they know how to do it. And I think that what we would have to hope to see is, like, that there will still be, you know, like, things like the Fight for 15 movement, and the Uber, you know, and all the other plethora of organizations, you guys know much more better than I, really pushing him to do stuff. And I think that we have to just be clear that we can see, you know, two hopes. And, like, one is that, like, besides capital fighting back, is also that I think there would be substantive changes on foreign policy. And what was interesting for me reading the two books, too, is that, like, you know, Sanders was much more openly critical of Israel than he had been in, I'd seen in the new book, than he was in the previous book at all. I don't think it even came up. You know, I think he's playing much more of a role in, like, trying to fight back through his foreign policy. And I think the only way to keep that going is, like, if we are mobilized, because that is something that you can easily compromise on. It's, like, the first thing you can give away is, like, let's just keep the status quo. We don't have to beat Trump. We don't have to be alienating our former major allies. Let's just go back to Obama, Bush era, and that would be like, people would be in DC would be very happy about that. So I think that's also something that I'm cautiously optimistic if he was president that he could stay good on, but it would really require a lot of movement there. So my time is up right now, so I'm just gonna pause there. I'm just gonna give it to Mike right now. Thank you.
Hello. Good evening, comrades. hope everybody's doing well. We're all in here nice and cool. It's hot outside, so thank you for air conditioning. Although there are some environmental issues there. In what seems like a blink of an eye, the American left has found itself in an entirely new strategic position. We have gone from defending what little we have against attack to being poised potentially to take the presidency. This is in the wake of several national, state, and local level electoral victories for Democratic Socialists in Congress, AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar. At the state level, Julia Salazar in New York, Gabrielle Acevedo and Vaughn Stewart in Maryland, Summer Lee and Sarah Inamoroto and Elizabeth Fiedler in Pennsylvania, Lee Carter in Virginia, Mike Sylvester in Maine. So we seem to be making electoral victories of some sort or another. Although we're far from there, the groundswell of popular interest in and support of democratic socialism offers up the real possibility for actual governing power. But despite the literal tidal wave of corporate money that is going to flow into the pockets of Biden and Harris, getting Bernie elected might end up being the easiest part of the whole game. Let's play through a thought experiment. What if Bernie Sanders actually wins this thing? What should socialist strategy look like then? Once in power, there are going to be two connected strategic issues that democratic socialists must grapple with. First, what role should social movement organizations, labor unions, ordinary citizens play in installing and pushing through a democratic socialist agenda? How might ordinary citizens be incorporated into the management of new public systems and mobilized into new modes of democratic decision making? In other words, if Bernie wins, what will the strategy external to the state be? Second, and distinct, what kind of agenda should elected democratic socialists actually push? What kind of program should be pushed first, and how might they win? In terms of just up and down votes, what is politically possible given constitutional constraints and the political composition of Congress as it's going to exist? What kind of executive orders should be issued? These questions concern the nuts and bolts of socialist wielding actual state power. Now, we often focus our strategy on the outside of power because we're rarely in it. But as Hillary Wainwright has recently written, we need a strategy both in and against the state. The American left has far less familiarity with questions of state power, is really a result of our historic marginality in American politics. There is, of course, a long history in the US of municipal socialism in cities like the place where I'm from, Milwaukee, where some of these questions have been grappled with. But the last time a socialist has come this close to winning the presidency was almost 100 years ago, Debs. This might be a reason why the American left has such sophisticated strategic thinking about outside strategy, the rank and file strategy, deep organizing, and the analysis of how protests win by Francis Fox Bivens and Richard Clower are the ones that most come to my mind. Let's take the best of what we have there and pursue it. But we rarely talk about policy itself as strategically, which is a major mistake in my view. If Bernie wins, his administration will be governing with the deck severely stacked against it. His democratic socialist agenda will be inheriting the balance of power largely as it exists today, one where business has far more influence in politics than do ordinary people, let alone democratic socialists. Much like left-wing governments in the past, a Sanders administration is likely to confront obstacles to governing that might weaken or derail its program at best, or at worst, turn towards austerity. We have a long list of socialist governments besieged and broken by capital's hostile reactions, whether it be Gonzalez in Spain, Papandreou or Syriza in Greece, Mitterrand in France, Lula in Brazil, Chavez in Venezuela, most tragically Allende in Chile. How might Bernie avoid a repeat of failures of the past? Our best bet, and that's just it, it's a gamble, is developing sharp clarity about the risks all meaningful politics entails some risk of losing. Here we need analyses of how reforms can break with the logic and the power of capital. To be strategic about policy, we need to understand the degree to which policy itself can advance a democratic socialist agenda by rendering capital, business, less able to effectively derail it. We know capital has power. The key question is, how does that power vary, and what can we do to weaken it? This is critical in my view. Once we understand how the power of business varies in capitalist societies, capitalist democracies like our own, we can then develop strategies to erode it, to create greater strategic space for socialists in government. Unionization, building rank and file power, and disruption are the key strategies for socialists outside of the state. But how might state policy work in coordination with those outside strategies? Let me first just very briefly discuss the main ways that I think capitalists have power in our democracy, and how a democratic socialist agenda might confront this power. The first is the way that firms and businesses are actively involved in politics. The most immediate way they might counter a democratic socialist agenda is through their interpersonal connections with policymakers and the civil service, through campaign financing, through lobbying, what business kind of euphemistically refers to as advocacy. Firms, whether it be individually, sectorally, or their business associations, are deeply involved in the policymaking process. They're constantly trying to control the state. And they tend to be better at it than we are, because there are fewer of them and they have more money. But there's a second way that businesses have power in politics as well, and that I want to call structural prominence. This concerns the political capacities that capital as a whole, or a sector, or even particular firms have by virtue of their role in the economy. In capitalist societies, most of the work and revenue generated is through capitalist firms. That's what makes it a capitalist society. As a result, politicians are dependent on a steady flow of investment from both firms to generate tax revenue that the state needs and to make jobs available to the population. What happens when firms stop investing? Well, you know the old saying, the only thing worse than working is not working, right? In the event that capitalists withdraw their investment in the economy or withhold new investments because of a bad business climate, what we call a capital strike, people will lose their jobs, the state will lose revenue from income taxes, and the electorate will likely blame the incumbent administration. But structural power varies. This is key. This is my key point. The power of a capital strike is inversely proportional to the ability of the government to respond to it. If the public sector is larger, if there is money that the government can spend to offset capital flight, it can weaken that power, right? Now, with respect to capital strikes or capital flight, the international context looms really large here. Firms might not only decide to withhold investment, they might actually move plants or their machinery, assets abroad, and investors could disinvest from financial assets. This is what we call capital flight. Because there are often real costs to moving plants, capital markets lay at the core here. A Sanders administration faces the potential risk that risk-averse investors would flee to more favorable business environments. Right? They would pull their money out of American stock and they'd put it in, you know, French stock or something like that. And there is historic precedence for this. In the UK since 1945, there have been 5 sterling crises, where basically investors dump the currency, they dump sterling-backed assets. When Greece faced a severe debt crisis in 2015, it was the aggressively austere posture of the European Central Bank and the Troika who made it clear to Syriza, the Syriza government, that it was willing to stand by and allow runs on Greek banks and devastation in their bond market. The Syriza government under Tsipras had ruled out an exit from the euro unequivocally as a show of its willingness to work within the EU, but the Troika were set on making an example of the Greeks and for the rest of the so-called pigs to see. With the masses supporting OHI largely ignored by the party, a bolder exit plans kept off the table. The government was disciplined from the outside, and the movement was left destabilized and demoralized. We typically talk about capital flight, right? Like capital moving out of a country. but like large capital market injections can be just as damaging. Rapid inflows of investment can drive up exchange rate appreciation and asset bubbles. For instance, during the Asian financial crisis in 1996 and 1997, the devaluation of the Thai currency, the baht, led to vampiric speculators coming in and betting on further devaluations that actually worsened the crisis. Currently in Puerto Rico, vulture hedge funds that are based in the US have undermined democratic governance on the island. Boston-based hedge fund Baupost has bought up nearly $1 billion in Puerto Rican debt after Hurricane Maria, which essentially devastated the island, used that financial leverage over the local government to impose an austerity plan on the island, which included selling off the public energy company, getting rid of holiday pay, and closing schools. There are also broader international constraints that a Sanders administration is very likely to face. Consider France in 1981, maybe our closest analog. That year, the newly elected socialist Mitterrand government began to implement its programme commune by nationalizing key sectors of the economy and redistributing downward. But these socialist changes did not lead to a clear path for socialism. Inflation of the dollar and the Deutschmark, which was a direct result of the Volcker shocks, increased the cost of imports. They forced severe devaluations of the franc. And the French socialist project basically sank on the shoals of an exchange crisis that was totally beyond its own doing. A democratic socialist government might be disciplined in this manner as well, especially one as dependent on imports as the US is. So business has these basic tools to wage war on a socialist government. And what is interesting is that much of this amounts to firms following a strategy that simply concerns managing their own businesses. One doesn't need to be virulently anti-socialist, though they are, to disinvest. All they need to do is look at market signals, telling them that it's more profitable to move their money elsewhere. So given these constraints, these economic forms of leverage that business has in politics, what sector should we be most worried about? Without a doubt, the biggest corporate threat to a Sanders government is the financial sector. We're now living in an era of finance capitalism. The financialization of capitalist economies has created greater macroeconomic instability for us, increased worker precarity, and severely deepened inequality. Furthermore, the incredible debt that both middle-income and poor workers find themselves in is a secondary form of exploitation, which happens through circulation. Firms lower wages to make more profits, then workers take out debt, whose interest payments flow back into the pockets of lenders. The financial sector plays an oversized role in American politics. It spends more in lobbying than does any other sector in the U.S. And its size makes us all directly dependent on how it's doing. Now, one line of defense that Democratic Socialist Administration might use is enforcing limits on the cross-border movement of financial and physical assets, what we call capital controls. Capital controls once were quite common, but they've largely been destroyed by neoliberalism. In the European Union, for instance, they're illegal, which is one of the reasons why some people support the idea of Lexit. A Sanders government should bring them back, in my view. They might be imposed through hard limits on flows as well as through taxes on transactions. There's different ways to go about it, but either would help us deal with the problem of capital flight. But what if domestic firms put a hold on reinvestment and sat tight until the government fell apart, like they tried to do with Allende in Chile before the coup? This might come as a surprise, but I think that the financial sector itself offers avenues for radical politics and a potential leverage against disinvestment. If financial flows are reallocated, they might neutralize the ill effects of disinvestment that have killed so many socialist programs in the past. When we talk about public banking, we typically think about it in terms of either filling gaps in the market, like getting people to have bank accounts that don't have them, or in its role in a broader development strategy. So, you know, people talk about the ways in which financial flows might be reallocated into renewables and zero carbon sources, into worker housing, infrastructure, green tech and public jobs and so on. But socialized finance might also make socialist governments more durable if allocated strategically. In the case of capitalist flight or an investment slowdown, public investment operates like a strike fund for society against capital. This means that a democratic socialist government in the US needs a strategy to weaken the power of Wall Street by controlling it for social ends. Thinking strategically about democratic socialist policy means thinking through the specifics for how to do this. Debate over policy reform shouldn't just concern economic feasibility, but also needs to address how the reforms themselves might alter the balance of class power in the US. With these ideas in mind, how should we begin thinking about democratizing finance in the economy? Well, I have only 30 seconds left. There's a whole host of options on the table, whether it be regulatory options like reviving Glass-Steagall or promoting responsible investment or public banking or sovereign wealth funds or nationalizing banking. Whatever approach we embrace, we should be thinking about it strategically, how the approach might actually help us weaken the power of business. This is the bottom line from my view. There's no royal road to democratic socialism. And even the best paths we have are totally covered with pitfalls. The best chance we have, though, is to navigate that path with no illusions and to develop policy and strategy that puts us in the best possible position. Thank you.